provincial and federal government documents during World War II and the immediate post-war period, it would be easy to assume that women worked almost exclusively in industrial production. The reality of women's working lives, though, was that the majority continued to work in and enter traditional jobs within the secondary labor market as public sector employees, restaurant workers, and in other caring and service professions. Between the period of October 1944 to the beginning of 1945, there was a big jump in the number of women moving into non-industrial jobs, and that's as layoffs were taking place within industrial production. Both the numbers of women and the sex ratios in occupations fell to pre-war numbers. In some areas, such as the hotel and restaurant industry, the numbers of women employed rose, while the actual percentages of the female labor force of the total in those areas fell, and that's because public sector jobs were opening up, as well as new jobs in communications and sales work that related to the beginning of post-war shifts in production priorities amongst business people. So what happened to wartime women workers in Canada was in some ways similar to the U.S. Women were really torn very quickly down from the kind of pedestal that they had occupied during the war. Instead of providing selfless service for the country in its hour of need, women were now occupying somebody else's job. That's what it came down to. And many war industries shut down, and there was an initial shortage of work for women and for all wartime workers. The pressure was big for women to step aside and make room for industrial male workers and returned soldiers. Jobs soon became available, though, for women as the boom swung into place in resource-rich British Columbia. But the attitudes of employers, co-workers, the community, and women themselves were marred by the fear of depression and traditional notions of women's place. There was less of a kind of anti-woman backlash in British Columbia than was expressed in Rosie the Riveter and I think in U.S. propaganda. And that's because of the relative strength of the union in many of the areas that women were working. The fact that wartime employment did continue for women in the central wood industry, which is, you know, a big part of BC's industrial development. And also because some of the war industry shut down so totally that it wasn't an issue like whether women would be laid off first or men or whatever. Everybody lost their jobs. Nonetheless, there was a new hostility to women workers, especially women in non-traditional jobs, and much public discussion of women's right to be present in the labor force. The war period, as we've kind of looked at, did develop a layer of women for whom it was very much a deep desire to remain in the labor force. They resisted through union and other means the pressure on them to leave the industrial workforce. And women stayed in secondary labor market jobs like the hotels and restaurants without much disruption. Other women left industry, but they returned very quickly as soon as they could find jobs, or after a year at home they got really bored after having worked in the kind of stimulus of industrial work. The height of hotel and restaurant organization in British Columbia took place between 1944 and 47, and I think this shows that there was a strong presence of women who had a sense of their right to remain at work and to fight for better conditions. Although it's in a traditional women's work sector, I think that if those women really had believed they didn't have a right to be in the workforce, that the union drive itself would have been undermined. I'm not sure, that's a point of discussion, but you know, I think that it does kind of give evidence to that. So women's work identity was shaped by the kind of contradictory nature of the government's wartime propaganda and by women working, the experience of working in a time when women's labor was socially valued. Women's work was accepted within the mainstream media and within other social institutions as a fact of life. So, you know, advertisements for women who are workers and new food products for the working woman and so on. Women's work identity was bolstered to undermine absenteeism and create an identification with the production process and production campaigns. So it was really a contradictory experience for women, because on one hand there was this notion of women being there in a very transitory way for a couple of years, and that was stated within government recruitment campaigns. At the same other point, there's all these ads that say, you know, your work is necessary, you are needed. And I think it made women feel like they didn't know whether they were coming or going out of the labor market. Women's workforce participation was often qualified by a reminder that they were working for their country in crisis, and that they would soon be able to return to normal, that is, the home. Conditions such as childcare, which could allow for long-term changes in attitude, were not realized. This temporary nature of women's image helped to reduce conflicts between industrial men and women. The latter did not, women did not constitute a permanent kind of competition for men. The messages from the government during the war were hazy enough that, combined with women's newfound self-respect and autonomy gained from wartime participation in productive work, union organization, and social activity, many women did develop a belief that their post-war employment was legitimate in society's eyes, and were quite surprised when it wasn't treated that way. Women who needed to work to support themselves and their families continued to need a job when the war ended. That didn't change for them. And others did indeed accept that their wartime work was temporary. Some were relieved to return home after balancing domestic responsibilities and workplace responsibilities. Some of the changes in the opportunities for work after the war influenced the development of women's desire to remain at work. A greater variety of permanent work had become available to working women. Aside from industrial jobs, there were openings in the public sector, in banks, and other financial institutions. This eased competition between women for work and facilitated improvement in the working environment. It was possible, finally, to look for an escape from what had once been a seasonal, isolated, and temporary relationship to the workplace. Initial hostility to women working had abated with the day-to-day experience of men and women on the job. Women proved themselves to be competent workers. The division of the primary labor market into skilled, semi-skilled, and craft workers meant that women did not generally work directly in the same jobs that men did, and therefore a kind of social closeness could be built without men's livelihood being threatened. So by 1943 to 1944, women constituted some 20% of the workforce in war industry. So it was with these experiences and expectations that women moved into the mass of layoffs within wartime production. After VE Day, the downturn in women's employment, which began in the last year of the war, increased dramatically. In British Columbia, women lost industrial jobs as part of the shutdown of entire industries, such as the aircraft industry. And as workers with less accrued seniority in industries that continued to produce but were decimated, and that's what happened in the shipyards. By 1948, the BC shipyards employed only 0.2% of the female labor force, and exclusively as clerical workers. And so that was a major shift from women being, them employing some 5% of the female labor force. By 1945, there was a 7.5 fall in employment in general in BC, but this was in reality a 13.5% drop in women's employment and only a 5% drop in men's employment. So, guess who was going? The specific jobs which women had entered to fill disappeared. So in the shipyards, women went with men as their skills were no longer needed, but then some of the areas where women had been employed, like in the bolt shop, they no longer needed to produce bolts for war ships. Like the specific kind of production that was wartime production was gone, and women filled those kinds of jobs. So women were basically, though, in the same position as men in many industries, fighting to keep a job. Okay. I just disorganized myself, excuse me. Okay, in the meantime, national selective service regulations which governed the labor market were lifted to recreate what was called a free labor environment. Price controls, rationing, rent controls, and more labor regulations were also lifted, although wage controls remained in place until the trade union movement forced them to be removed. Subsidies for wartime daycare in Quebec and Ontario were cut in 1945. And a confusing revision of the income tax law occurred in January, 1947, which limited a married man's exemption for a working wife to $250 a year. So earnings of women within the family above this sum were taxable. There was massive confusion about this, and many couples believed that all of the earnings that a couple made above $250, whether male or female, were now taxable, and women left the labor market because of this. Like, a lot of women quit their jobs because their earnings were so low that if they were heavily taxed, they wouldn't really be contributing to the family income. It's quite amusing, though, because by 1947, the demand for women in the service sector was up, and employers protested the loss of cheap female labor because of these new tax revisions. The federal government was really embarrassed and spent a lot of money on advertising to try and explain its new rules, but still many women left. The government had created a committee on the post-war employment problems of women, and it was a subcommittee of the Advisory Committee on Reconstruction. This committee believed that women's future happiness depended on full employment, which in turn depended on the conversion of war industries to consumer production. They believed that women had proved themselves through the war and established a permanent place in engineering, technical shop work, and personnel management. They figured that some 4,700,000 people would need post-war jobs. To achieve full male employment, some half of married women working in 1944 would need to return home. So it turned out that the government definition of full employment, in fact, was full male employment. Based on... Yeah, right. That's a very good point. If you look at unemployment statistics, they don't look at women who are within the household who have left work and might otherwise be seeking employment and whose unemployment is hidden. Yeah. And then they also don't look at statistics for welfare. Yeah, so when you hear that unemployment is like 12% or whatever, it's in fact at least double that. If you look at women and... Based on a survey by a woman named Mrs. Ethel Caldwell, some 180,000 women would need new work opportunities in addition to 38,000 Canadian Armed Forces veterans. So what was required was massive job creation. In analyzing the situation, one woman writer argued that employers would not lay off women because they depended on their skills. A quandary existed. Wartime women workers were resistant to returning to temporary and poorly paid domestic and agricultural labor. Yet the employment of women in these jobs was essential if the goal of full employment was to be realized. The solution which women advisors developed was the upgrading of these work areas, including their inclusion in labor standards and a new social respect for the work. A similarity between the former low status of women's professions, such as teaching and nursing, was constantly drawn, that these professions had been underpaid and not really valued by society, but now they were receiving the respect that was due to them, and the same could happen for domestic and agricultural workers. Well, a lot of women who had worked during the war did not buy that. Farm women's organizations and electrification were needed, it was felt, to encourage women to go back to the land. A dominant view of government and government critics was that if women were to work after the war, it must be in traditional job areas. Even in industry, women were told to return to a more feminine niche. Without any discussion with women workers, like they did all these surveys that showed that women did not want to return to traditional jobs, right, and wanted to keep their jobs. However, without any discussion with women workers, government literature assumed that women would prefer this appropriation of their hard-won industrial skills. And here's a quote. Women workers, as a rule, do not consider riveting and welding the glamour occupation of peacetime. The type of production jobs they like are the type women have long filled. Assembling, testing, inspection, machine operating, other than sewing machines. These are the factory jobs in which most women excel. Women war workers excel in peacetime. They prefer metalwork to garments or textile factories. Women like such work because it gives them the opportunity to use their finger dexterity, exercise responsibility, and pay attention to minute details. So this, I find this quote really interesting because it's laden with contradictions. Like, they know that women don't want to go back to traditional women's industrial jobs, which for the most part in Canada were always textile and garment production. I mean, inevitably. And there was some, like, light fabrication and electrical plants, right? And that kind of grew after the war. But so they recognize that women actually don't want to return to traditional job areas. But what they do is they take that and they say, well, women do want to be able to use their skills. And it really corresponds to the literature before the war and in the early part of the war, where they talk about how women are really suited to industry because they're very good at minute details and doing boring work. So there's that kind of tradition that carries through, and it actually doesn't correspond to what any of the women I interviewed said or any of the surveys which the government actually does do of wartime women workers. Yeah, it is. It is, and it has a lot to do with the fact that women's work is so built in, you know, wage work is so built on traditional roles that women play. Yeah, and that's a good point. The United Canadian Veterans Training Program, which was supposed to find jobs for veterans, including women who had served in the armed forces, and that was the prime job-finding place. Okay, now their priorities for women were completely limited to female occupations. They would find women who had been in the armed forces jobs in domestic and restaurant work, dressmaking, nursing, hairdressing, and commercial clerical work, and they trained them for those jobs. So they offered absolutely nothing for women who wanted to learn welding, for example. The women's division placed great emphasis on making domestic work attractive to wartime women workers. Employment officers were forced to admit that women did not want to re-enter these jobs. A, quote, reversal in women's wartime employment was apparently hampered, quote, only by the sharp resistance of demobilized personnel to downgrading. Employers and government continued to chastise women for not accepting low-paid jobs throughout the 1940s. A 1949 survey of restaurant workers echoes the earlier reticence of women to enter domestic work. The hours of work, the loss of social prestige, poor working conditions, heavy work, the lack of opportunities for advancement combined to make waitressing jobs unattractive. While the federal government set employment policy, the BC government expressed confusion in its attitude to wartime women workers. While outlining the layoffs displacing women at Boeing's, the government also stated that women in coveralls had become a familiar sight. They had established their mechanical abilities and would perhaps continue in the light, repetitive work of consumer production. The province recognized the diversity of opinion on women's right to a job, pages and pages of recognizing it. But rather than set independent policy, it decided that it would wait and see if, quote, a wholesale exodus of women would occur. So what you find in the Canadian government is this incredibly kind of laissez-faire attitude, and they assume that the market will balance itself out to its, quote, natural state, which it did, which meant traditional work for women and traditional work for men. The responsibility seems to rest again on women to resolve their employment situation. The province's Department of Labor Women's Division did pledge its help in assisting women to make the transition in the workplace. The division recognized that some women had always worked outside the home, and that now more would need to do so in order to compensate for wartime casualties and to support their families. The Women's Division argued that the province's Department of Labor must be concerned for all women, no matter what their marital status or race, but to little effect. As BC women moved out of industry, factory regulations to protect women were brought into provincial law. A 35-pound lifting limit was introduced for women. Women were required to be seated during factory production, which is like a really major regulation if you look at women's work within the wood industry, because none of those jobs are seated jobs. And also the weightlifting regulation also. So by 1947, the province's recognition of women's wartime contribution and the needs of the female war worker had become, quote, the satisfaction of knowing that they had performed an excellent job for their country in a time of need. I think 45. And you know that's been used against women in the wood industry. Yeah, everywhere, right? And that actually, that introduction of weight regulations and the year that came in parallels what took place in the United States, because it came into many state labor laws, protective laws, at about the same time, and was used in a very similar fashion against women working in the auto industry and the electrical industry. And it, you know, it's interesting because the debates were not only taking place within sort of a national level, but also within the International Labor Organization that set policy for what should be international standards for women, and they were also discussing the need to protect women from lifting these weights and so on this time. Women faced not only government ambivalence and hostility, but shifts in employer, union, and public attitudes as well. One of the most hurtful aspects of the change in women's status was the growing hostility of other women to those women who worked. Women who had not contributed to wartime production may have been jealous of the missed opportunity, as some women who I interviewed suggest. Married women feared that women who worked were depressing their husbands' wages or even denying them a job. There was a really tremendous experiential gap between women who had worked or had been in the armed forces and those women who stayed at home during the war. Upper-class women were some of the strongest opponents of women's right to a job. Annabel Maud Hill, who was a women writer in British Columbia at the time, attacked working women in a speech at the Women's Institute.
Is that
No. She was in Alberta, wasn't she? She's BC? Okay. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Right. Sorry about that. No, it wasn't her. This is a woman who wrote fiction and also she was a journalist. She used to tour around and speak to the women's institutes, which existed in every little town in British Columbia. And she just went on a rampage against working women. She feared that there would be massive unemployment and also that the family would be weakened if women insisted on remaining on the job. War contracts had terminated, she said, and international production was uncertain and reconversion plans unclear. Canada's foremost responsibility was to veterans who needed jobs and immigrants from the war-torn countries of Europe. Returned men had to adjust to family life. War destroyed expectations, apathy in the context of a lack of apathy and the context of a lack of leadership at home. Women, on the other hand, had developed a newfound economic status with a commensurate independent attitude, self-confidence from training, self-validation and freedom from domestic expectations. She believed that such women had to be convinced to return home, either as wives, parents, or domestic servants. I mean, the domestic servant thing is there in everything, right? For this to happen, they must be convinced of the social importance of childbearing and homemaking. The stigma must be removed from domestic work. She continued with a denunciation of wartime domestic workers, wartime workers with domestic responsibilities, I mean. And she felt that women were solely responsible for the many latchkey children and for juvenile delinquency. She ends with a recognition that women could not be, quote, shooed back to the home. At least 50% of women wanted to keep their jobs, mostly because their families required their incomes. For the others, social security measures were necessary. Women, if they were going to work for wages, should do so as home workers, that is domestics, cooks, educators, and for the church. And she also encouraged women not to work for wages, but to work as volunteers. So there's this real impetus for volunteerism again. Women who had given their talents to the war could now turn them to bettering their communities. Other women added their voices to the Back to the Home movement. A woman named Tilly Ralston, she was the MLA for the Vancouver Point Grey area. And she stated that, quote, women with children under 16 should keep their homes together and raise their families, unquote. Divorces, she believed, were the fault of working wives and, quote, absentee mothers, and they also were the cause of juvenile crime. If women remained on the job, they would only clog the labor market. Women workers who dealt with the public described harassment by married women and other members of the public. I'm going to read you this quote. It's from a woman named Edra McLeod, who was a conductorette during the war. She used to ring the bells and collect fares. And then what happened is there is this kind of massive technological change in terms of the transit system at the end of the war. And they converted the streetcars to buses. And the company wanted to get rid of the women. The women who worked for BC Hydro, BC Electric, interestingly, had full status within the union. And they had fought for that, but the men had also wanted the women to have full status. In Winnipeg and other cities, the women worked on a special ticket, and at the end of the war, they were all laid off because they were temporary workers. But here, they actually had full union status because the men were afraid that if the women had special status, they wouldn't have union benefits and wages, and it would undermine their contract. So because of that, there wasn't that much resistance in the union, because the women had been working in the area for like quite a long time, 4 or 5 years, and the union felt that they had been good unionists, and they also had maintained conditions. So the guys basically supported women keeping their jobs. So the women, though, had a fight to become bus drivers, and what the company did is it argued that the insurance company would not insure women bus drivers, and the insurance company backed up the company and said that they didn't want to insure women because they were probably dangerous drivers. There was no record of this whatsoever, right? And that it would be high risk for them. So the women fought it and eventually got trained as bus drivers and stayed on the job. And then it was quite interesting because the women scored this little statistical victory, which is that the women, of course, were safer drivers, just because, I mean, in part because there were fewer of them to have accidents, right? And also they tended to live longer and stay healthier. And a lot of the men, when they reached their 40s, would have heart attacks because it's a really high-stress job. And the women all stayed on and retired at, you know, 65, right, and cost the insurance company virtually no money while it was busy dealing out all this money for the guys. And it was kind of one of those ironic little things. But here's the quote. Andy, my brother who worked at the Coca-Cola factory, came back to his job, and all the men on the streetcars. One fellow came to me and he said, "Do you know why I quit when I came home from overseas?" I said, "I bet it was because I was on this job." And he said, "Yes, I guess I was kind of foolish, wasn't I? I considered it a man's job, and when I came back and saw that women were doing it, I wasn't going to have any truck with that one." And this was the feeling. On the street, I found that women my own age were resentful of me having that job, or resentful of not even having had the experience. People just came up and insulted you, telling you, "You're taking this job away from some man." For a couple of years, it was just steadily. And I'd say, "Are you prepared to keep me in the manner I'm accustomed to?" This was how you felt. They didn't even ask me if my husband had come back from overseas. Just, "Get off that damn job." And in her case, her husband came back and then he left her. Like, he'd been away for 6 years. He signed up in 1939. And he was over there for 6 years and he came back and the marriage didn't work out. And she'd had a kid by him. And he just couldn't cope with having to deal with a family, and he left her, and she supported this child, and she had to work, right? But there was no sympathy for that at all, right? Okay. Some critics combine their belief that women should not work with arguments against equal pay for women. They believed that if women received equal pay, they would ultimately desert their families and remain in the workforce. Women would only choose homemaking if their, quote, dazzling careers outside the home was made as unattractive as possible. The family, the backbone of a civilized world, would crack under the impact of women working. Again, juvenile delinquency, so prevalent during the war, would intensify. They felt that it was men's role to support women and children, that they should receive higher wages and women should remain at home. Quote, equal pay for equal work means the dissolution of the marriage system. End of quote. This guy goes, one of the writers went on to say that slum conditions for the working class was preferable to equal pay for women. Employers also made it clear to women that they were no longer welcome on the job. Women who had worked in shipyards asked to train for full trade programs after the war. They were told that the war would be ending and that there soon would be no more work for women. One employer was quoted in the province as believing that the displacement of women, quote, was the best news in 5 years, although others did say that they would miss women war workers because they were really competent. Hostility to women working was expressed by veterans rejoining the wartime workforce or post-war workforce. Unlike their male counterparts who had stayed in Canada, they had no experience of the tremendous wartime contribution which women had made. Rather, they saw women as undermining their legitimate dominance within the workplace. Some men refused to return to occupations where women were employed. The media played an important role in demobilizing women. The province enthusiastically predicted the, quote, speedy exodus of women from war plants where they were frozen. Frozen means that, like, during the war, the wartime regulations meant that people couldn't leave their jobs. They had to apply to leave a job and to change a job. And that was true for war industries. And it applied to men. But women at the very end of the war were excluded within the, included in the regulations because they were so desperate to maintain the war labor force. So one of the things the government did very quickly was to lift the freeze on wartime labor. The idea that women were choosing to leave industry was stressed again and again. The paper stated that skilled jobs for women in waitressing, hotel service, and office work awaited former war workers. No mention of women's concern and anger at job loss and downgrading was made. Okay, so most people kind of divided their opinion between sending women back to the home or simply to their appropriate location within the labor market. Three currents battled for the hearts and minds of Canadians. Conservative forces, psychologists, veterans, and some branches of government argued for the total removal of women from industrial work, and to some extent from the workforce in general. Others, particularly government agencies dealing with women, argued that women could remain in the workforce, but within traditional job sectors, opportunities and training must be opened in these areas. But others yet, women themselves, unions, and more radical groups, argued that women had proven themselves during the war and had the right to employment in any job that they chose. The government's interest in the issue was premised on the need to manipulate the labor supply through the post-war return of soldiers and the re-establishment of a peacetime economy. And the government was caught between pressures from opponents and supporters of the women's right to work. Both sides looked to the government for clarification of women's peacetime role, and anxiety about the future crescendoed in 1945-46 as women were pushed out of industry and as there was that kind of dip in job opportunities and people thought they were heading for another depression. But as the evidence kind of shows, both the federal and provincial governments followed very pragmatic policies and in fact didn't really make policy. And right before the war ended, because there was a continued demand for wartime supplies and a drought of needed labor in the service sector, wartime women's employment counselors continued to urge women into the labor force. So in 1944, all 20 to 24-year-old women were registered with the National Selective Service, permission required to leave a job in industry, as I said. And women continued to pour into the workforce, reaching 41% of the industrial labor force. At the same time, the layoffs began, and approximately 60,000 women lost their jobs in the industrial sector. The layoff priorities of the government placed married women whose husbands were considered able to support them well up on the list, and this policy encouraged means tests and more subtle forms of harassment, and the only thing that cut against this was trade unionism. so that, and I'll read you some examples of the debates around this, but like in the Boilermakers Union in the shipyards, the union actually said that they did not support means tests, right, which meant that women had some protection, but in a lot of other industries, or where the unions were more conservative or more sexist, married women were pushed out first. They were just simply laid off first. That's what happened. At the same time, federal government policy stated kind of glibly that in every case of layoffs, arrangements have been made to offer them all available opportunities of suitable employment. This statement is rather ambiguous. Who made the arrangements, what was in fact available, and what was considered suitable, and by whom, employers or women, were never resolved issues. Many surveys by the Selective Service showed an unqualified desire on the part of the majority of women asked to remain on the job. There was no coherent government plan for the post-war employment of women, however. Employers who were consulted by the Selective Service, who had operations in steel, iron manufacture, animal, vegetable, and textile products, all intended to reduce women's employment to pre-war levels. In some instances, this meant the elimination of female labor. In others, it meant a return to unskilled, ill-paid work. Firms asked stated that they would employ 17% fewer women by 1 year after the war's end. Rather than challenge these returns, the government predicted the reestablishment of pre-war sex ratios. The government promised certain post-war reforms which could affect women's work opportunities, and these included the public development of housing, social security, unemployment insurance, health care, family allowances, and old age protection. Social protection would stabilize consumer spending and create private sector jobs in the service industries. Full employment would result from high productivity and increased services. What in fact did happen from these policies as a kind of side effect was that the public sector developed and women were pulled into those jobs. Okay. In the government's opinion, women were withdrawing from the labor market not because there weren't job opportunities and not because of depressed conditions, but because, quote, a considerable number of those released from munitions plants were married women, and they did not become an employment problem because of a preference to devote all their time to homemaking. Yeah. Okay. So, in terms of women I spoke to, women experienced, quote, a tremendous letdown after the war as they moved from industrial jobs to jobs, for example, in Woodward Bakery. One woman who had been earning something like, I think around $30 a week, her wages fell to $17.50 a week. One woman described helping to organize against layoffs and finally being forced to find work in Port Angeles. She couldn't find work in Vancouver. Eight of the women I interviewed left the labor force within several years of the war's end, primarily to marry and raise children. However, of these, five later returned to the workforce, which meant sometimes a return to union activity. One woman stayed home while her children were young, and because her husband believed that she should. And this woman, it's incredible, she was like one of the central organizers of women and of the union in the Boeing's aircraft plant, and so was her husband, and then he refused to let her work while the kids were young. But finally, she returned to work because of economic necessity. Another woman returned around 6 years after she was laid off to her pre-war employment in the garment industry. Women who were single, women, single parents, and separated or divorced people generally remained employed. These women who stayed in the labor force clearly were forced to harden themselves against public opinion. If union militants at least initially fought to remain in the labor force, many of their less active sisters also shared the kind of anxiety that these women were consciously stating. So here's a quote on that from Johnny Rankin. One of the issues that was talked about was after the war, an industry, and developing industry, and a chance for jobs to continue. And a lot of women were concerned about that because it was work now, and a lot of the women were concerned with buying back their self-respect. So Some were just able to pay off stuff. A lot of them had made arrangements with their husbands. There were some separations that occurred, but we had a new status, that it was the beginning of women being accepted equally in industry, which is still going on, the fight for that. We had a lot of worries about work, and at that time we thought we were going to build a big merchant fleet. Women wanted to continue working and wanted daycare and wanted some independence and equality, and it was a lot talked about. In Boeing's aircraft, as well as the shipyards where she was working, women were afraid of losing their jobs. While the union proposed, quote, desperate plans against layoff, unquote, women felt both tremendous anxiety about the future and squeezed out of the labor force. Marge Storm, who worked in the wood industry, describes the high degree of turnover of both men and women after the war in the wood industry. Those women who remained constituted a more permanent layer of workers than previously and were intent on defending their right to remain. Then when the crunch came and they realized that they could do the job and they liked the job, as I was saying to you before, a person, when they get out and work like that, they've become individuals and they have their own individuality. They've developed a personality that a woman doesn't have the opportunity to develop if she doesn't get out amongst other people. So after the war ended in the wood industry, women revised their attitudes towards unionism. Marge Storm theorized that it was the decline in the numbers of women in the mills which led to an awareness of the importance of equal work. Women were no longer surrounded by other women but could compare their wages to those of men in the industry. As well, women realized that they lacked job mobility. Resistance was a delicate balance, as women would leave the industry if they felt too isolated from other women rather than fight. Successful campaigns for equal pay merely led the companies to stop hiring women. Further declines in the number of women in the industry occurred as women who left were replaced by men. There was a strong feeling amongst women war workers that they would not return to conditions and jobs similar to those they held before the war. Okay, so one woman I interviewed believed that women in the hotel and restaurant industry became more selective of the houses and hotels in which they would work after the war. And some of the Boeing's women who were forced back into agricultural labor as berry pickers, when they were laid off, began a campaign for union organization and helped to organize the fruit and vegetable workers union in BC. So that was another thing that I found quite a bit, was that women who had been involved in wartime unionism took those lessons into the new job areas they went into, even though they were traditional women's work, and became trade unionists there. So, an hour nonstop talking. I'll stop there and maybe we can talk a bit about that and then take a bit of a break, and I'll talk about two specific situations of women, two industries where women were laid off and where women fought for post-war conditions, and then we'll hear some of the testimony from people. So, do you see any differences between the Canadian material and the American? Or those people who saw the movie? Yeah, that's
they
true.
Usually do
right. See, then that's... Right, that's interesting, too, because that's something I'm going to talk about in a minute, but during the war, women actually, like, they were in sub-departments of the wood industry. Like, most women worked in the same areas as younger guys and really old men, and then there were women, and they weren't in the green end. And so they worked in specific kinds of jobs, and they also worked in like box factories, that kind of thing, you know. But there were a fair number of women who worked at the same work that men did. And they did everything. They even worked on saws, you know, and they worked as graders and so on. Well, what happens after the war is that women are totally pushed out of those kinds of jobs. And women end up far more segregated than they were before within the sub-departments. And they also end up on separate seniority lists in traditional women's work, which kind of institutionalizes that division of labor. Same with the fishing industry, eh? I mean, they're just, a friend of mine works at BC Packers out in Steveston, no, Richmond, and she's a shop steward there, and they just fought this year to integrate the seniority list. I mean, they finally got it, you know, and the union had adopted the perspective that they wanted to do that quite a number of years ago, but the employers were just absolutely resistant to it, and not only that, a lot of the men in the union were really resistant to it as well. And
well, when they did it, sugar, they read
in the case of this fish plant, like, the woman I know is a forklift driver, and she's the first woman who's driven forklift there in, I think, 9 years. And the company is just rabid about not employing women as forklift drivers. And they're always saying, oh, well, women can't lift the weights, right? And in fact, there's hardly any heavy carrying involved in the job. It's very rare, right? And none of the men do it, right? So they use the 35-pound weight limit a lot, and they've tried to use that as an excuse. Well, what she did is she argued that on the basis of the amount of seniority she had, that she should...